Thanks for listening to the Best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
I want to break into two different stories here to start off the third hour, both of which I think are significant. First of all, the woeful, awful, very bad NFC East had a woeful, very bad game last night that the Philadelphia Eagles managed to survive and win. I'm sorry, Giants fans, second straight divisional game that you managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. I thought this game was summed up quite well by Daniel Jones doing the read option, having the entire field wide open in front of him, breaking into the open field, nobody around him, and then he trips and falls. Now, the Giants went on to score on that drive. It would have been maybe NFC East perfection if we had seen a fumble go through the back of the end zone or something of that nature. I thought we had almost a perfect NFC East ending when it looked like the Eagles were going to score. They had a first and goal from the two or the three, and then they get a 15-yard penalty for a helmet getting yanked off by one of their offensive linemen, and then we get an absolute dime dropped in by Carson Wentz to save his team on, I think it was second and 18, second and goal from the 18. Absolutely perfect throw to Boston Scott, I believe it was, out of the backfield. Couldn't have been any better of a throw. Congratulations, Eagle fans. At 2-4-1, you now are in first place in the NFC East. Let me repeat that. At 2-4-1, you now are in first place in the NFC East. I never would have believed that 2-4-1 would ever be a record, especially this close to halfway through the NFC East's calendar, that would ever be a situation where anybody would be in first place with that record. And by the way, like a lot of you, I was like, man, is 2-4-1 better than 2-4? I didn't know, because we don't have very often half game situations predicated also on a tie being involved. So I wasn't even sure what the math is. But the math, the winning percentage is a little bit better for 2-4-1 than it is 2-4. So that's how we end up in this scenario where 2-4-1 is better than 2-4. All right. So that is the takeaway from the NFC East game. We'll see what happens with Dallas going on the road against the Washington football team. Also, later tonight, the Big Ten is officially back. And for those of you who are longtime listeners to this program, and by longtime, I mean you've been listening since at least March, you know that I have been fighting as hard as I possibly can to get sports back. And a big part of getting sports back has been getting college football back. And so for months on this show, we advocated for Big Ten players, for Big Ten parents, for Big Ten coaches, for Big Ten fans, for everybody out there who was trying to make the Big Ten happen. We fought as hard as we possibly could to make that a reality. And Wednesday, I was in the Oval Office, and I was having a lot of conversations with people who had worked as hard as they could in the Oval Office to get the Big Ten back as well, from the president all the way down to a lot of the staffers that we were interacting with. And this was just a tremendous home run. Whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent, if you're listening to this show right now, I know that you are probably a fan of college football and of football in general. And so I am ecstatic that the Big Ten has managed to find its way back to playing. And I think this story is so good and so deserves to be told that we are talking right now at Outkick about doing our first ever documentary on the battle to save college football. And I think I can get a lot of the people, whether it's the conference commissioners, whether it's the president of the United States, whether it's the White House officials, I think I can get a lot of them all to tell the story, probably some players as well, maybe Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, guys to sit down and actually talk about what they did. I also think some coaches, whether it's James Franklin, whether it is Ryan Day, Jim Harbaugh, Scott Frost, so many different coaches and administrators out there who fought as hard as they possibly could to get college football back as well. I can't wait. I really think we may do this at OutKick, our first ever long-form documentary telling the story of the behind-the-scenes battle that had to be waged in order for college football to be played this fall, and a huge part of it is the Big Ten. So with the Big Ten returning, the schedule, they're playing a full slate of games this weekend. I know that a lot of you out there are listening to me, wherever you may be across this country. There are Big Ten fans everywhere. But I want you to know that I know how good it feels to play college football. And I'm just glad that you're going to be able to play, even if early on in the season, let's say you're an Illinois fan, you're like, man, I don't know that we really needed to play this season. Or if you're a Rutgers fan, or you're a fan of one of these teams, Maryland, Northwestern, at least one of you is going to win this weekend. We have got a full slate of seven different Big Ten games going on, and the first one will be tonight on the Big Ten Network with Illinois going up against Wisconsin. So all of that, very positive. I want to also remind you that I'm not just saying that I'm excited for football to be back. I'm going to the games myself. I went to the Bills-Titans game. I went to the Texans-Titans game. And this weekend, come Friday afternoon, as soon as I finish my TV show, I'm hopping into a car with a couple of buddies and headed up to Knoxville to watch the Alabama Crimson Tide run roughshod all over my Tennessee Volunteers. But I'm going to be excited to be sitting in a crowd for a college football game as well. I think we all need to get back to our normal lives, learn how to live with COVID instead of cower in fear from it.
This is OutKick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
We are joined now by Lance Taylor at the Lance Taylor 94.5 Jocks down in Birmingham. Appreciate him swinging by to join us as he does many different Friday mornings. So, LT, I want to start with this. I know we talked about it last week in some way, but the Nick Saban having COVID story and then how the story just disappeared is kind of fascinating, right? And he coaches and like it's like it never happened now. But for a week, it was all everybody was talking about after he announced that he was positive. And then Alabama goes out and gets the big win over Georgia. They've now beaten A&M. So the Saban angle, but also with the A&M win and the win over Georgia, do you kind of feel like Alabama's cruising now? Like it's like they've been through the trials and tribulations already. The last six on their schedule don't look very tough, and that starts with Tennessee and Knoxville this weekend coming off of a bad loss against Kentucky.
You know, outside of the game and Baton Rouge, which, you know, we'll see if LSU is able to rebound tomorrow against South Carolina. I think they're going to be 14-plus point favorites in every game at least.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I agree with you, man. I just don't think they're really going to be challenged. I thought it was an interesting first half against Georgia, and at times this young defense looks a little lost. Pete Golding, the defensive coordinator, is taking a lot of heat. But they got right in the second half, man. I mean, you know, to be down at four at half, to outscore Georgia 21-0 in that second half. Mac Jones, I mean, there is, you know, people talk about maybe a step back with going from Tua to Mac. Tua seemed like a generational player, the best quarterback in Alabama history. Mac Jones, I'm not going to say he's better than Tua. That would be a bold statement, but his deep ball, the way he's played up until this point, the weapons around him, I mean, this offense is, if it's not the best in college football, it's one of the top two or three.
There's no doubt at all about it. Now, I know you watch a lot of college football too, and I watched Alabama, and again, given the context of the way the situation is set up now with Alabama, such a huge favorite, as you mentioned, the rest of the way, and having already beaten A&M and having already beaten Georgia, I think Alabama's basically penciled themselves into the college football playoff because even if they – I think they're going to go 10-0. And then they go to Atlanta. It doesn't really matter who they play. Probably Georgia or Florida would be a huge upset if it wasn't one of those two. Even if they lost that game, they'd be in the playoff because they'd be 10-1. I feel like Clemson came out and just absolutely took it to Georgia Tech. I mean, 73-9. I know Notre Dame, UNC, they may have aspirations for the ACC title. We've already seen Clemson take down Miami in a big way. I'd be stunned if Clemson isn't in the college football playoff. Are you with me that basically you can almost write in Clemson and Alabama this season?
Yeah, 100%. And I think they'll probably be a 1 and 2 seed. And I think ultimately we'll see them play for a national championship. The wild card is obviously Ohio State. We've yet to see the Big Ten play. They seem to be getting a layup this weekend, opening up with Nebraska. You know, people think that Penn State is one of these fringe contenders. I know you're good friends with James Franklin. I'm not buying it. I think Penn State's got maybe the trickiest game in the Big Ten this weekend, heading to Bloomington, a really difficult game last year for the Nittany Lions. This Indiana offense can score points, so I think that's going to be a really interesting game tomorrow. But, you know, Ohio State is that wild card, but I agree with you. I think Clemson, Alabama, I'd be borderline shocked if those two are not in the college football playoff this year.
I know that we spend a lot of time talking about things that go bad, but the SEC, knock on wood, looks like all four games scheduled for today are going to play. Sorry, by today, I mean tomorrow. Auburn, Ole Miss, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, Missouri, South Carolina, LSU. It's a fairly weak slate so far. But what letter grade would you give the SEC, and what would your expectation have been if I had told you through the first 5 weeks of the season the SEC was going to get 30 out of the 32 games they had scheduled all in?
Yeah, are you talking about what grade are we giving teams overall, the league?
The fact that we're actually going to have, like if you've been setting an over-under for postponements, it appears we're going to have 30 out of the 32 games scheduled basically as they were to be played. That seems like an extraordinary success rate as we come up on almost halfway through the season for many teams.
That's an A+. I mean, you look at the Big 12, it seems like they're missing games every other weekend. I mean, when's the last time we saw Baylor out? Oklahoma State has been affected by this. You know, there's teams all over the country and programs that have been affected by COVID, and the SEC has cruised along. So I agree. I mean, that's remarkable when you think about the percentages. I mean, it's really NFL-like.
Yeah, I mean, it totally is. Speaking of NFL-like, there's not a ton, I would say, of huge college football games. The Big Ten obviously playing is a big storyline. I talked about that some to open up the show about how excited I am just to have the Big Ten back in general. When you go to the NFL, I watch them all the time, so I'm not sure how much time you've spent watching the Titans. I've been and watched them play twice in person. First time against the Bills, second time against the Texans. The Steelers are coming to town this weekend. Are you as impressed by the Titans as I am? What do you expect in the Titans-Steelers game? And how wacky is it? Usually you don't see the NFL lines move that much. This line has moved like 4 points from the Steelers as a 2-point favorite to the most recent line that I have seen with the Titans around a 2-point favorite.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, too. I don't know if you realize this. Only the 8th matchup in NFL history of teams 5-0 or better against each other. And, you know, Tennessee last weekend, unfortunately, I had the Texans. I don't know why Romeo Crennel went for 2 in that situation. The only way I could get beat, you know, is that game going to overtime. They lose the toss, and then Derrick Henry takes the game over. That was a bad beat, and Derrick Henry is a man. But hey, I know you probably know this. The last 16 games together, Derrick Henry and Ryan Tannehill are 13-3, which is ridiculous. And that offense is averaging about 31 points per game. So the Titans have a legitimate offense. I think you can make a MVP argument for either one of those guys. Defense at times gives up some big plays, and that's my fear with Pittsburgh. Chase Claypool might be your NFL Rookie of the Year right now, at least until this point. You know, James Conner is playing at a high level. You know, they've got Juju. Ben Roethlisberger seems to be healthy. They've got arguably the best defense in football. I've just got a feeling Pittsburgh goes on the road and knocks off your Titans. I think it'll be a hell of a game, though.
Here's a story that I'm going to talk about this a little bit later in the program, I think, because I do think it's a pretty significant story. All of the Titans players who tested positive for COVID are back, and they're effectively going to be playing this weekend on Sunday. So every time one of these guys tested positive, it was an, oh my God, it's unbelievable. The Titans have another positive. Everybody was running around like their hair was on fire. Now all of these players are back. None of them have had any kind of significant health issue at all. And I bet I'm the only person out there with a national sports talk radio show who will even point out that all of the players who had tested positive and were not able to play for a while are back, and the Titans have their full roster and allotment of players without any COVID-related issues. Shouldn't that be a pretty big story if we're going to treat all of the positives as massive stories? Shouldn't the return of all these players without any sort of significant health impact be significant as well?
Absolutely. I didn't even really know that until you just said it.
I mean, you're not hearing it from anybody. But you saw all the positives, like I'm saying, right? Like you saw the drumbeat of, oh my God, here's another positive.
if any staffer gets tested positive, you hear about it. So, yeah, I think it's very significant. I think it's obviously been underreported. And back to Nick Saban, you're right, it was a huge story until the fact that he gets three negative tests in a row and they call it a false positive and he's able to coach. And then everybody just kind of drops the whole situation. You know, and I thought that whole – you wonder, Clay, I mean, if that's Will Muschamp that tests positive or Kalani Sitake at BYU, do you think they're even given the opportunity to have three more tests to see if they can actually
– Well, I think this is a credit to the SEC, but honestly what it makes me think – so, you know, we went to the White House on Wednesday, and I had to get a COVID test in order to be able to have access to the West Wing and to the leaders of the nation, which, you know, probably is a good proxy, a good position to have, right? And so I tested negative, right? And that's the second COVID test that I've had since March. I took a COVID test back in July. People who listen to this program, they had drive-through COVID testing in my part of town in Nashville. And I was like, you know what? I want to know what a test actually feels like if I'm going to be talking about as many positive and negative tests and everything else. I want to know what the protocol was like. So I tested negative back in, I think it was July. Somebody can go check the archives. I talked about it on this program. Drove through. And I mean, that was like the excessive test, right? Where they basically put a probe. It feels like all the way up into your brain to rub it around. The new one at the White House that they were doing took an hour to get a result. And it was just a basic nasal swab. It wasn't in any way difficult. It didn't hurt. And they do it for the press in the West Wing pretty much every day. If you're covering the White House, they are there and they make the choice to kind of give you a little bit of a nasal swab, right? Like that's a commonplace activity there that they do. But I've now been tested twice. When I see all these false positives, and Nick Saban is a good example, and we've seen them happen a ton with players and with different support staff, and those guys are getting tested multiple times, they have the luxury to be able to go back and say, wait a minute, this is negative, instead of positive. How many people out there tested positive and never had it at all and quarantined for 2 weeks and didn't work and kept their kids out of school? I mean, I don't think it's crazy to think there are millions of people in the country that applies to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it could be as significant as 15-20%. I mean, really, who knows the number? I mean, I know so many people that have tested positive. Like you said, they've been quarantined for 10 days.
Didn't have any symptoms, didn't feel bad at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they felt completely fine. And they're like, you know, it's basically just watching Netflix. I know guys that have been out, you know, running 6 miles a day.
Yeah.
Still drinking because they're like, I just don't feel it. I feel great. But I tested positive, and I can't go back to work, and my kids can't go to school. And so, yeah, I agree with you. It's probably a significant number that we'll never know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely crazy. All right, as we kind of look forward for college football and the NFL, so we talked about the Steelers and we talked about the Titans, 5-0, both. You think the Steelers are going to win. Do you buy into the Seahawks with their defense being able to maintain the level of excellence that they've shown so far, particularly in the really tough NFC West, where I know you're a fan of the Rams, so you watch a lot of those games. Where do we go from here? Are the Seahawks truly the best team in the NFC?
Well, I mean, the good news for the Seahawks is you might have the best player in football right now in Russell Wilson with the 19 touchdowns through five games, which is second most in history. It's been amazing offensively. DK Metcalf, I think I've seen you tweet before, is he the best receiver in the NFL? You could at least make that argument right now.
Yep.
So they've got the weapons offensively along with Lockett. I think Chris Carson is a guy that can do a lot of things out of the backfield. But you're right, defensively, I'm not sure. And now you get Kyler Murray, and I've got – kind of a weird situation. One of my best friends decided not to get Sunday ticket, and he's a Cardinals fan. So the Rams-Cardinals games have been staggered back and forth with a lot of East Coast games. So he's been able to come over here and watch his Cardinals. So I've been stuck watching the Arizona Cardinals. And Kyler Murray is one of these electric players, but in 22 starts, he's 9-12-1 and still has a million balls batted down. So, you know, he's an electric guy when he gets on the outside and he creates with the feet. And obviously having DeAndre Hopkins has been a big lift for that offense. But if the Seahawks really want to flex this weekend, you know, you can't get beat by Kyler Murray. I think the Seahawks -3.5 on the road. I kind of like them in this spot. And I think the defense is going to get better. I mean, Pete Carroll's a defensive guy.
Yeah, you would think at some point they are going to get better. We'll have to see from there going forward. Do you expect – I know I'm bouncing around from NFL and college football, but I want to go back to the Big Ten being back in play. Do you expect for Ohio State to truly be head and shoulders above everybody else in the Big Ten? We talked already about the fact that Clemson and Alabama feel like kind of foregone conclusions to be in the college football playoff. Is Ohio State that much better than everybody else in the Big Ten?
I think they probably are. You know, it's almost a Lincoln Riley from it, and this is probably a bad example this year with Oklahoma. But for the first three seasons with Lincoln Riley and Norman from Bob Stoops, and that's kind of what it looked like last year, making the transition from Urban Meyer to Ryan Day. They've just got SEC athletes all over the place. And Justin Fields and that offense, I think they're going to be nearly impossible to stop in that conference. And I really just don't know who competes with them. You know, next week against Penn State will be interesting. We'll see what Penn State looks like this week against Indiana. But outside of that, you know, Jack Cohn is injured for Wisconsin. Michigan's breaking in a new quarterback in Joe Milton. And, you know, Harbaugh, you can go on and just book it. He's going to lose at least three games every year. That's just kind of the way it is. They've got a difficult opener in Minnesota. So, yeah, I think it's Ohio State and everybody else. It almost reminds me right now of what you've got back to Alabama in the SEC and Clemson in the ACC.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've made the analogy for a long time that Clemson right now in the ACC feels like USC back in the days of Leinart, Bush, and Lindell when they were absolutely dominant and nobody else was on their same level. And I know UNC and Miami and Notre Dame are pretenders for the ACC crown, but I don't think they're real contenders. And so I think right now you would have to make Ohio State, even though we haven't seen them play, which obviously is a bit of an exaggeration, but we'll see this weekend against Nebraska how they look, and I expect that the answer will be really good. And then Clemson and then Alabama. And the team to me that is kind of under the radar and could sneak its way into the playoff and not many people are talking about, I'm curious if you think this as well, is Texas A&M. Because if you look at the remainder of their schedule, there's a decent chance they make the run all the way to 9-1. I think you would have to look at their schedule and say there's a very good chance they go 8-2, and I don't think 9-1 is out of the question at all. And if that happens and Alabama beats Georgia or Florida in the SEC title game, since those teams already have one loss, I think there could be a chance that 9-1 A&M is sitting there and might look like the best available option outside of Ohio State, Alabama, and Clemson.
You know, I mean, there's a possibility. I'm not sold on this A&M team. Another double-digit win this past weekend against Mississippi State with an offense that is completely lost right now. I just don't trust Kellen Mond. You know, had the game of his life against Florida and that first top five win for Jimbo as A&M's head coach. We'll see where they go. You know, the interesting thing is before COVID and the reschedule in the SEC and the conference-only schedule, I thought A&M had one of the easiest schedules in college football, and I thought it was going to be a layup for them to go 10-2 just based on that schedule. And then the reschedule, I thought they got punished the worst, and I thought they had one of the more difficult schedules. But based on the way the first 4 weeks of the SEC has played out, now it does look possible that they could navigate and go 9-1. But again, is Kellen Mond going to be able to be consistently good week to week? And I still think there's a lot of teams that can beat A&M. I mean, you just look at a team like, you know, from Arkansas, Ole Miss. I mean, these are teams, you know, week in, week out, that can just pop up and beat you.
Yeah, and that's the question, whether A&M is going to have the wherewithal or stick-to-itiveness to be substantially better, even a Tennessee or an Auburn with Bo Nix and Jarrett Garantano, who both Auburn and Tennessee fans are completely fed up with. It's possible that one of those guys could have a decent game, and suddenly they are in position to steal a game from A&M. And plus, we've seen Jimbo's team slip up before, right? Even when they were great at Florida State, they were in a lot of tight games with teams that were substantially inferior. As we roll into the weekend, appreciate you joining us, my man, and hope you have a good final weekend before Halloween. By the way, what are you doing for Halloween? Are you coming to the Halloween party?
I'm thinking about coming out to your Halloween party. I mean, the good news is it's Friday night, so I can still get, you know, settled and watch all the games on Saturday. You know, as far as Halloween, I'm watching games. But, yeah, there's a good possibility. I mean, I would think that you've got one of these over-the-top, you know, swanky parties. I mean, how crazy do the costumes have to be? I've been thinking about this.
Well, I mean, people are pretty dressed up. You know, I mean, it's not like an insane, I don't know. I don't even know how to describe, but everybody has to come in a costume. So like, you can't show up like in a, you know, basic, everybody is noticeably in costumes. I wouldn't say it's swanky. I mean, there's lots of alcohol and everybody has a good time, but yeah, I think you'd have a good time if you come up.
Okay, have you already decided? I know you probably don't want to break it out, you know, coast to coast right now, what you're going as, but if you are, yeah. You guys have already figured out the costumes? Okay.
Yeah, my wife has picked our costumes the last 4 years, and they have been at least somewhat couple costume-y, which when you throw a Halloween party, I think
so you're
kind of the expert.
So you guys could be going as Bill and Hillary Clinton, right?
Yeah, we could theoretically be Bill and Hillary Clinton. We're not Bill and Hillary. Like, I'll give you examples. Last year, I was Jon Snow and she was Daenerys right after Jon Snow stabbed her, right? So like, dagger, like the dagger in her stomach that was, kind of fastened. And then I was Jon Snow. The year before that, I was Macho Man and she was Miss Elizabeth. And the year before that, I can't even remember exactly what it was. And she'd probably remember a lot better than I would. So we've had, the couple costumes for a while, as we've been having our Halloween parties.
Okay, so I'm going to try to make plans. I'm going to sleep on your couch. So Laura's okay with that.
You know what the truth is? There are so many hotel rooms that don't cost anything right now because almost no one is on the roads anywhere. So, I mean, you can get an incredible hotel room in Nashville right now for $100, which ordinarily is not the case at all.
I know. You remember you and I, we had the Airbnb for a preseason game, and things got a little sideways.
Yeah, I tried to get you a place booked because it was impossible to actually get a hotel room. I mean, like, for a while there, Nash, that's true.
It's the last time I slept on a futon. I was a grown man sleeping on a futon when I came in because we could not get a hotel because Nashville used to be the biggest pain in the ass town to get a hotel in.
That's true. I mean, the city was so underbuilt for hotels, and that's really what kind of led Airbnbs all over the city of Nashville to explode. A lot of people, that was the only place they could find to stay. LT, we will talk to you. Hopefully I'll talk to you next week, and hopefully I'll see you at the party next week as well.
Yeah, perfect. Have a great weekend, Clay.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
John Morosi, our Major League Baseball insider, he is down in Arlington, Texas, getting ready for Game 3 of the World Series. Series tied up at one game apiece. John, how would you, first of all, thanks for getting up early with us for this Friday. And secondly, how would you assess the overall World Series at the 1-1 tie? Is it what you expected? And how would you assess going forward with theoretically as many as 5 games still to come?
Well, Clay, to me, and first of all, good morning. Always great to talk ball with you. I think that the Rays have shown themselves in Game 2 that they have a path to win this series. They may not be the favorites. I still think the Dodgers are the favorites. But the Rays have shown with the way that they played in Game 2, Brandon Lau, who was their best position player during the regular season, had a huge Game 2, 2 home runs, both to the opposite field. His swing looks like it's locked in right now. And so with Lau getting back and the overall run scoring bouncing back after a disappointing Game 1 for Tampa Bay, their bullpen looked sharp in Game 2 for the most part. Of course, it got a little interesting late. But I think overall, they've got to like where they're set up. And they have now in Game 3, which is also, by the way, the matchup for an, if necessary, Game 7, Charlie Morton, who has been one of the best playoff pitchers of this century, the last 20 years. Charlie Morton has been extraordinary in a lot of clinching games. Of course, he was in that situation for them in Game 7 against the Astros. He was excellent for them against the Yankees as well. So the Rays feel very good. It's a polar opposite payroll scenario, Clay, with the Dodgers having the second largest and the Rays having the third smallest. But for a few players on the top end, of course, and Mookie Betts has been extraordinary. Of course, the graduate Overton High School there in the great city of Nashville. I think overall the teams are much more closely matched than a lot of people would have thought, who would have said, okay, the Dodgers are clearly the better team. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think it's very, very close, and I think the Rays have a legitimate chance to win this World Series.
Okay, you mentioned Mookie Betts. Watching him throughout the postseason, I mean, I think, and I may even ask you about this, the Braves series in general and the way that ended. The catch he made in Game 5, I believe it was, the shoe top catch that then got Marcell Ozuna doubled off for not tagging correctly. The catch he made back against the wall in Game 6, I believe, and maybe it was Game 5 as well. And then clearly the takeaway of a home run. I think that legitimately would have been a home run for Freddie Freeman, but for his catch. That's not even taking into account his play at the plate, the fact that he's already the MVP. Is this an all-time bad decision by the Red Sox franchise to allow him to leave?
Yes, it is.
Right? I mean, and it's not like they're poor. You know, sometimes it's a financial constraint situation, right? Where a team is a small market team and they realize that they got a guy who wants to make $30 million a year or whatever the heck it is, and they just don't have the resources to be able to do it. For instance, if Mookie Betts had come up with the Rays probably would not have been able to keep him unless they got him signed to one of those early contracts where they gave him a lot of money guaranteed before he had proven he was going to be a superstar of superstars and put him in a tough spot. Hey, do I take $100 million now or do I roll the dice, right? Sometimes they can do that with younger players and be able to kind of lock them in at rates. But it's crazy to me that a big market team that is lucrative and has as much money as the Red Sox would make the decision to just let Mookie Betts walk. And it's not like he's 39 years old either. I mean, he's got a lot of really good years left.
Well, you're right, Clay, and that's exactly the point. The comparison I made recently was, this reminds me a little of when the Marlins traded Miguel Cabrera, a Hall of Fame player. But the difference was, they were the Marlins before the new ballpark came around, and these are the Red Sox. That's a move that you would have expected the Marlins to make a decade ago, but that the Red Sox should not have to make now or ever. And the issue with the Red Sox is twofold. Number one, they invested a lot of money, because all teams have budgets, even the rich ones. They invested a bunch of money in pitching when they didn't really have to. They signed Chris Sale to an extension and Nathan Eovaldi as well after they won the World Series in 2018. And if you added together Sale's money and Eovaldi's money, it would get you almost to the point, at least on a per-year basis, where Mookie's money would have been. And so they decided to sign two pitchers who have been injury-prone since then, instead of allocating that money to Mookie Betts. It's also true that they still made him a pretty good offer. Around the neighborhood, reports say of about $200 million. I mean, they offered him real money. But I think that the Red Sox all along, whether it was in how they approached him, when they approached him, Mookie had always consistently said with the Red Sox that I want to go to free agency. And they never really seemed to publicly or privately say that they were going to go above and beyond to make sure that they talked him out of that. That they didn't really go that extra mile. The Dodgers, meanwhile, when he got over there, it was as if they were wooing the best recruit in the country from day one. And the way that the ownership spoke with him, teammates, the chance to win, Dodger Stadium, chance to be great for a long time, living in L.A. I mean, there were a lot of things about L.A., just the space and freedom and flexibility that you have there. Well, I really think that in some ways, it's hard to describe this unless you're really familiar with the sports culture in both cities, but I think you understand this. Boston with baseball is a total fishbowl. It's a small, big town. Like everybody knows who
yes.
you are, and they're on top of you. In L.A., there are famous people everywhere. And so being famous, it's not quite the same burden in L.A. because you can sort of distribute the fame more equally around all of your neighbors. And I think that is appealing to Mookie, who is both an incredibly engaging personality, but also I think likes his private time and space too. So I think it's just a perfect fit for him. LA in some ways was more appealing for him than Boston ever would have been, but I do think that Boston could have done a couple things differently to convince him to stay.
It's a little bit like Nashville. Mookie's building a big house not far from where we live in Nashville, and you mentioned earlier that he lives in Nashville, but grew up in Nashville. There is a certain amount of space that a city like Nashville gives celebrities that they may not get in other places. And that's because of all the celebrity music people and everything else in this city. In LA, you know, there's this idea of, oh, we don't want to overreact to celebrities. There's so many of them. And also trying to just give space. I think that same thing exists in Nashville. And I can see how it could feel a little bit overwhelming in a place like Boston, which is a bigger city than Nashville, but where the amount of attention on a guy like Mookie Betts may be overwhelming.
It's a great point, and I know from speaking with my brother about all of his years living in Nashville, he's always said that when you see country music stars out at the restaurants,
you leave them alone.
The deal is that you leave them alone. Exactly. He said
you
the reason why
you
they
don't
like
see
living
them.
Here.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's because we don't bother them. We're polite to them. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I've been out at restaurants an absolute ton of times when and by the way, it's not just country music anymore. There's a lot of rock stars. There's a lot of, you know, Justin Timberlake is here. There's a lot of people from a different variety of music now. But they walk by and everybody like leans over and whispers, but it's like you don't move your eyes. You know, it's like a certain like omerta, like where you pretend like the code is you pretend that you didn't see them, but you all like lean over at your restaurant and you're like, hey, did you see so-and-so? He or she just walked by. And you might say something. If you say something, it's like, hey, I appreciate the work, but you don't spend a lot of time like kind of getting obsessed with it. And it is kind of fascinating in that respect. Now, I want to go back. I said I was going to mention we had two Game 7s. And the Rays almost gave away their Game 7 performance. They were up 3-0 and then allowed the Astros to come roaring back to force a Game 7. And the Braves were up 3-1, and they actually lost their series despite having a big lead. Is there? I know it's only a 60-game season. Is there any lasting impact into next season from a team giving up a lead like the Braves did, or a team fighting back and almost getting it done like the Astros did? Or is this season so unique it's like a one-offer, and by the time we get back to spring training again in February or March, nobody will really reference very much of what happened last season?
It's a great question, and I think, Clay, that the players, and I've heard this now from multiple players who have said this in the last couple weeks, it feels like 162 by now, because the playoffs have been long, and they've been long in the sense of there's been not been a lot of off days. Of course, this is the first series that we have an off day. This is it. This is the first in-series off day that we've had so far is today, or rather Thursday.
Yeah.
And I think that the key thing there is you've got that sense of the emotional weight, the mental weight, the physical weight of this year. And I think that the players feel mentally and somewhat physically tired because of the demands of this playoff schedule, and also just the stop and start nature of the year, that they feel tired. So their bodies are telling them that this was a real long season, even though by games played, it wasn't. And I think that we're going to see the teams that win it, the team that wins it will have that same gratification as if it was a normal six-month season, and maybe even heightened because of the circumstances in which they're winning. And I think, too, that from the Braves' perspective, and I know we've talked a lot about them this year, I think there is no shame in losing to the Dodgers. I really believe that. Even though they had a 3-1 lead, the Dodgers are a quality team, an excellent team, a thorough team. The at-bats they have are excellent, and I think that they're a very worthy winner of the National League. If I'm the Braves, I am more upset at how I lost with the base running mistakes, because yep. That's where, for a young, yes, they're a young team, but I at this time of year, Clay, I always sort of, it's hard for me when I hear people say, well, we're just starting our window, we're going to have a lot of years to win. You never know that. Pitching is very fickle. You're never sure how long it's going to last. And they had a great chance to win this year. They really, truly did. And I think that when there was no shame to me in losing a 3-1 lead against the Dodgers, but when you feel like you've given up runs on the bases in three consecutive losses,
yes,
and that key base running mistake there on the double play, those are things, Clay, that I think are going to stay with that team, and hopefully, if you're a Braves fan, motivates them to be a little sharper in that regard in 2021.
We're talking to John Morosi. He's our Major League Baseball insider. Okay, we've talked a lot about what has happened. Let's go forward from here. You said you think it's going to be competitive, and that probably the Rays are undervalued relative to the Dodgers, as potentially we stare down who's going to be the first to win three games with potentially five games remaining. The other question here is, how does, you mentioned that the day's off, Thursday is off, I think you got three games, then you get another day off. How does that slot for pitching, and will we see Clayton Kershaw again?
I think we will. Certainly, with Kershaw having started game one, he's lined up for five, so he's almost certain to
guaranteed to be back.
Yeah, and that's good. I think it's good for the storyline of this season, this series. Clayton Kershaw has pitched a lot better in the playoffs than people give him credit for. He's won 12 playoff games now. That's the third most in the wild card era after only Andy Pettitte and Justin Verlander. I mean, he's had a pretty great career. Yes, he's had some ill-timed innings that have gotten away from him in October's past. He's still a great pitcher, and I believe that he will come up with another strong start in Game 5. And again, to the point, it makes it for a better story. We now know that he's going to pitch at least one more time, and if it's a seventh game matchup, you're going to have Walker Buehler against Charlie Morton, which, to me, those are two of the top 10 pitchers among starters in the wild card era in the playoffs, with both their ERAs being under 3. So, yes, there's been a lot of relief pitching that sort of guided the storylines here, but there are still still some great starting pitching storylines to be had. And I do think, Clay, that to your question about Kershaw, no matter how this goes, this series and this month will probably be remembered according to, did Clayton Kershaw lead the Dodgers to a championship or did he not? It may not be fair, but this is a team that has tremendous expectations. This is, in my years covering the playoffs, and I've been lucky to be around it for a while, this is the best Dodger team I have seen of the last 8 years when they've won the championship in the NL West every year. This is their best team. This is their best team top to bottom. They should win the World Series. And if they don't, it's just going to be a very agonizing winter. It's not that the Rays don't deserve it, because they frankly do too. But this is the best version of the Dodgers, and for them to not win this year, I think, would be quite devastating to them and their fan base.
What does it feel like to see fans in the stands for the World Series? I know they were there for the NLCS as well, but on television, it just sounds so much more normal. And obviously, the Dodgers have traveled to Dallas fans and have just taken over that stadium. What has your experience been like kind of looking at a baseball games with crowds in them again, even though I think I'm correct that we've only had 9 total baseball games that have had crowds present, the 7 in the NLCS and 2 first games in the World Series. But it just feels like there's a different energy in the park.
It really does, Clay, and I've been grateful just to be at these games, and certainly happy for the fans that have been able to attend, and obviously baseball's done a lot of really scientific research on how to space them out and with the different requirements about masks and distancing, which I think that the key thing for baseball is to find ways to get fans back in the stadium and set the momentum forward for how to safely do it in 2021. That's the key thing, is to try to have this as a segue towards a broader look at how do we get fans back in the ballpark safely in the next year. But it's been great to have the volume back and hearing fans again. I mean, that sound of a crowd reacting to an exciting play, it's just, Clay, it sounds so good again. It really does. And so I feel grateful for that to have happened. And I would honestly tell you that the Braves-Dodgers series, I think because of the strong regional connection for the Braves, you probably had more Braves fans there for the NLCS than you've had so far with the Rays for this World Series. Now, that may change, of course, with this now being the weekend. Maybe more people can come travel in from Florida. But the Braves have such a strong footprint that Game 6 of the last series was loud. There were a lot of Braves fans around, as you know, the way your sons got into the team.
I had a flight booked to Dallas to come and watch some of the World Series with my 10-year-old. And it didn't happen, obviously. And I told him about it afterwards, which probably added insult to the injury. But he fell asleep with the Braves up 3-2 in Game 7, and I was like, "Oh, it's going to be a tough one," you know, when you wake up the next morning and realize. But the Titans are having a good year for him, so that helps. And also, he's, like I said, been a fan of Alabama for the last 3 or 4 years, and they never lose anything.
And you had a pretty busy week yourself, Clay.
Yeah, I did. And we were talking a little bit about that off air. It was surreal. I mean, you know, regardless of what political background you have out there, anybody listening, when you walk into the West Wing because of a scheduled interview with the President of the United States, and I'll say the first, like, there were a lot of, like, oh my goodness moments, but the door to the Roosevelt Room was open, right? And so, and for people who don't know, that iconic picture of Teddy Roosevelt that is you've seen probably in history books everywhere. And we walked in there. I had my 12-year-old with me, and it was an empty room. And I walked in because I wanted him to see that. And I said, "Have you seen this picture before, this painting?" And he said, "Yeah, Dad, it's in my, you know, it's in my American history book that I'm studying in school right now," right? And just walking around in that Roosevelt Room, It was crazy, right? And then getting to be in the Oval Office, meet the president, and having OutKick conducting an interview there in the White House. I mean, there were just so many surreal moments that I remember thinking, you kind of want to pinch yourself because you've seen either on television or in, you know, pop culture representations of the White House before, so many different representative samples of what the West Wing looks like. And then to find yourself there and be in the middle of it all for a day was really pretty much unbelievable.
Well, congratulations, Clay, to you and to Jason and the whole company for a really great week. And also, you had a baseball connection there because, of course, Sean Gilmartin pitched for the Rays this year, and his wife works in the White House.
I didn't even know that.
Kelly McEnany.
Yeah.
Kelly McEnany.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
She's married to him. Right.
Yep.
I met her, you know, walking through, and obviously she was there watching the interview that that Jason Whitlock did. I totally forgot about her her sports connection.
Yeah, it all comes back to the World Series. These worlds of sports and politics, Clay, always closely related, my friend.
Well, and I'll tell you this: regardless of who, and I'm sure you've experienced this as well, regardless of the political party that is in power in the White House, there are a ton of big sports fans that work in politics, and I think it's probably something that attracts, you know, because it's competition. Right? You have a winner
sure.
and
oh, yeah,
loser
absolutely.
In every election. And as people age out of being able to be involved in athletics, I think there is that same competitive charge involved for many of them in being involved in politics. And I've found, and I'm sure you have too, over the years, doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, who it is, there are just tons in the world of politics, big sports fans. And I always find that interesting because when I meet people who might be in that field, they want to immediately talk about sports, right? And that is that's always interesting when you think about the fact that, hey, the president's probably sitting down watching the World Series, regardless of who his party is, or a big game in the NFL or college football, just like many of the people that are out there listening to us right now.
Yeah, I think what wasn't a reference during one of the hearings recently, I think Senator Sasse mentioned something about the Astros, and Senator Cruz and Senator Cornyn took exception to it, I believe.
Yeah, yes, that's right. Who knows, maybe in the future when this election is over, we'll come back to politicians arguing about sporting events instead of arguing about election results. But in the meantime, John Morosi, enjoy your time down in Arlington. We'll be watching more of the World Series. I know a lot of Dodger fans waking up right now hoping that game three, getting that 2-1 series lead is important, like getting that 3-2 series lead if you're tied up after four. So we'll see who takes the proverbial brass ring and takes the advantage here.
Well, Clay, always a pleasure, my friend. Congratulations again on a great week. And please tell your son, keep the faith, the Braves have some better years ahead. I really believe that they've got some World Series in their future with that young core. So tell them thanks for following during the course of the year.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
We've got the return of the Big Ten. We're going to get into that in a little bit. We've got the biggest game in the NFL, maybe of the season so far. Honestly, when you consider the context, two undefeated teams this far into the season doesn't happen very often. We've got the Titans going up against the Steelers in Nashville. I will be on the road in Knoxville watching the University of Tennessee host Alabama. I expect an absolute bloodbath with the Tide rolling all over the Vols for a 14th straight season, which is crazy for me to be saying. Honestly, it's wild to me that it has been that long since Tennessee beat Alabama. And as a part of that, we will be having, hopefully, a fun time around that. And we're doing, if you're familiar at all with the Knoxville area, or you're listening to us and you're going to be there for the game, and I still think, you know, it's not 100,000 people, but there will still be 25,000 people in the stadium. We're going to do an event in the parking lot of Calhoun's, which is a restaurant on the river in downtown Knoxville from 1 to 3 Eastern. So if you're going to be in Knoxville and you want to swing by and check us out, I know I'm going to be answering questions from my buddy Chad Withrow. We're going to be right there on the Tennessee River. Maybe a little bit of a messy weather situation. Not sure. Looks like some rain may be coming in, but we'll try to make the most of it. And we're trying to get back to some form of normalcy with what hopefully will be a fun pregame tailgate event from 1 to 3 Eastern in the Calhoun's parking lot. You'll be able to see us. It'll be an Outkick event. So that is going on. And those of you out there who are regular listeners to the program know that on Friday, I like to bring in Dub, and we like to do our draft of the best games that are going on this weekend, both college and NFL. And I'm going to start it off and start in the NFL. And the game that I'm going to draft is not going to be a surprise to very many people. It is the Steelers on the road against the Titans. Now, there's a couple of things that I think are fascinating about this story in general. But in particular, it's rare to have this kind of situation where it's NFL week 7 or later, and you have two undefeated teams. In fact, and this is pretty wild, This has only happened 7 times so far in the history of the NFL that we get 2 undefeated teams playing in week 7 or later. Now, I thought this was kind of interesting, so I thought I'd run through it because a lot of these teams I've never heard of. Back in 1921, we had the Akron Pros going up against the Buffalo All-Americans. And if I know anything about the Akron Pros back in the day, it was they were a little bit suspect on the offensive side of the ball. And the Buffalo All-Americans, sometimes they couldn't take advantage of poor offenses. And so as a result, by the way, I'm making all that up. As a result, the teams ended up in a 0-0 tie. All right. So back in 1921, the Akron Pros and the Buffalo All-Americans played to a tie. How about the next time? 1923, the Canton Bulldogs, who went on and won the league championship that year, were playing against the Chicago Cardinals. And the Canton Bulldogs went on the road. And if you know anything about this Canton Bulldogs team, you know it was really hard for them to be intimidated by any kind of road environment. And they won 7-3. And then we fast forward 50 years to the modern day NFL. And in October of 1973, the 6-0 Rams went up against the 6-0 Minnesota Vikings. And the Vikings found a way to win 10-9. All right, I think this is kind of interesting. From a historical perspective, it doesn't happen very often. Then we jump another 30 years into the future, and some of you out there may start to remember some of these games. The Jets. It was fonder times for the Jets in these days. At the Patriots, they were both 5-0, and the Patriots won 13-7. Then in 2007, the Patriots, again, at the Dallas Cowboys, they were both 5-0. The Patriots won 48-27. And then in 07, we had the Patriots. And I believe, Dub, you can look that up. I think the 07 Patriots, was that the Randy Moss Patriots team that tried to go undefeated? I think it might have been.
That's the one.
That's the one. All right. The Patriots that year were 8-0. And I remember this game. I just remember how big it was. And they were going up against the Indianapolis Colts, Peyton Manning, Tom Brady. And the Patriots found a way to win 24-20. That was a late in the season, relatively speaking, game when both the Patriots and the Colts were undefeated. And then in 2015, the Packers 6-0 at the 6-0 Denver Broncos, and the Broncos spanked them. That was Aaron Rodgers against, I believe, Peyton Manning. So all of those games, it doesn't happen very often. And so putting that into context, what we're talking about, if anything, I think this game may be a little bit underhyped, and we may not be giving enough props to it because I'm really excited to see what's going to happen. An early teaser, this is going to be in my Outkick six pack. I'm not going to tell you exactly what the score is going to be because I don't want to give away the Outkick six pack, which we always give out in the final segment of Friday's show. But I'm fairly optimistic this is going to be a really good football game. I can't wait to watch. I'm actually not going to be able to attend this game because I'll be in Knoxville for the Tennessee-Alabama game. And I've been to the last 2 Titans games, but I think this one comes down to the wire. I think it's by far the best game of the NFL weekend as I just ran through all of the other games that have been taking place with undefeated teams involved. You can tell it is a rare occurrence. This could be an AFC Championship game preview. Both teams dealing with substantial injuries. You've got Taylor Lewan, who is out for what is going to be the rest of the season with an ACL tear on the Titans offensive line at left tackle. You've got Devin Bush, who is basically the linchpin of that really, really talented Pittsburgh Steeler defense. And now he is out for the season as well. Both teams coming off of pretty good runs that they've been on, obviously, to get to 5-0. The Pittsburgh Steelers have not been 4-0 or better, now 5-0 since the 1970s. The Titans have only been 5-0 once before. And so this is going to be a real rumble. I can't wait to see what's going to happen. I think it's the best game in the NFL. I think even you would acknowledge that, Dub. And of course, I got the advantage of drafting first, which is why I took it. What would you say about this battle between the Titans and the Steelers? How good do you expect it to be? And what game would you counter me with as being another one that is interesting or worthy of drafting to watch this weekend?
I don't think there's any question that the game you selected is by far the best on the board. 2 undefeated teams. Ryan Tannehill been playing out of his mind. I'll be curious to see how he fares against the Steelers defense that is, I think it's the reason you put them at number one in your power rankings this week. And it's hard to disagree with that. So Derrick Henry, Ryan Tannehill, we'll see what they can come up with against in a game of two undefeated teams. I'm going to go to Sunday Night Football, a game that was originally supposed to be, I believe, during the day, and then with the Raiders' COVID scares, it got flexed up to Sunday Night Football, and that's the Seahawks and the Cardinals. And this is a battle between two undersized quarterbacks. A lot of people compare Kyler Murray to his counterpart on Sunday Night Football, Russell Wilson, and I'm excited for this one. Now, you might automatically think, hey, this is going to be a shootout, the Cardinals and the Seahawks, two, you know, high-flying offenses, but the Cardinals this season, they're the only team in the NFL that hasn't had a game go over the total so far, which is pretty shocking when you consider the amount of points that have been scored left and right this season. So I would not be surprised if this game is a bit lower scoring than some people might imagine. And Arizona getting some points at home, they've been playing really well. We saw the absolute beatdown that they put on the Cowboys and Andy Dalton. So they're a pretty hot team. Seattle, I don't know how they do it, but the last couple of seasons, they just win games somehow, some way with Russell Wilson. And a lot of the times it's games they really have no business winning. So I think this is going to be a tight game, and I think it's going to end up like these Seahawks games usually end up, and that's Russell Wilson making plays late. It should be an exciting one on Sunday Night Football.
All right, so the NFL picks, clearly the Steelers on the road against the Titans. And by the way, I don't know why that game didn't get flexed into the night. Honestly, like,
great point.
If you were the NFL right now, why would you not flex the battle of 2-5-0 teams into primetime? That I just don't understand. And maybe there's something to do that I'm not sophisticated enough from a television market perspective. Maybe they were already out west and the crew, it was easier to get them to a western game. I don't know exactly, but it seems very strange to me that you would make the decision to not put the Titans and the Steelers in primetime, given how rare a matchup of 2-5-0 teams is. But I'm happy to have it played at 1 o'clock Eastern. Let's dive into college football now. Dub, I will let you make the first selection in the college football firmament there and all the schedule. Who would you take?
Well, the Big Ten is back this weekend, so I feel it's only right to have a Big Ten matchup be the number one pick in our college football game draft. And I'm going with Michigan in Minnesota. This is a game between two ranked teams coming in. And here's a fun fact for you. This would probably, you wouldn't expect this. When Michigan plays Minnesota on Saturday, it will be the first time that Jim Harbaugh opens up a season as the head coach at Michigan with a starting quarterback that he recruited out of high school.
It's wild.
It's an amazing stat. And it's really, I mean, it's remarkable. I would have never thought that that could even be possible. But here we are. So Michigan, new quarterback, a lot of guys out, a lot of new guys coming in. And Minnesota, I would know better than most because Minnesota put an absolute beatdown on Auburn last year in the Outback Bowl. This is a good team, and they're at home, and somehow they're getting 3 points. I don't really understand that at all because Minnesota's got some players coming back with their quarterback Tanner Morgan, wide receiver Rashad Bateman. He's a player. He's probably going to be a first-round pick. I think this is going to be a high-scoring game. Big Ten's back, and I think this is the game of the week in college football.
It's first of all, I agree with you, and I was actually talking with the OutKick crew today, and I was saying we haven't never done a documentary before. We interviewed the president. We were growing and getting bigger and better every single day. It's a big undertaking to do an actual documentary, but I think the story of how college football was saved when everybody gave it up for dead is one that needs to be told. And I think there are a lot of commissioners. I think there are a lot of people that were battling inside of commissioners' offices. I think it needs to be told, including from the president of the United States all the way through the commissioner of the Big Ten, Kevin Warren, commissioner of the SEC, Greg Sankey. So I'm just excited, and congratulations to all the Big Ten fans out there. And if you're new to this show, you missed several months of me battling as hard as I possibly could on behalf of the Big Ten being able to play. So I'm with you. I also agree that basically the draft pick in college football this weekend in honor of the Big Ten players, administrators, coaches, parents, fans, everybody refusing to acquiesce when the season was canceled and making the decision to fight for it and actually winning that battle is pretty remarkable that we are here. So I am going to draft another Big Ten game. And in particular, I'm not sure how good this game is going to be, but I just want to salute Nebraska and also Ohio State, Scott Frost, Ryan Day, for fighting as hard as they possibly can to make this season happen. And I am just thrilled, regardless of what happens, that the Big Ten season is going to happen and that the Pac-12 and the Mountain West and the MAC all got in line and readjusted their decision-making when they finally had sense brought to them and brought to bear. So I'll say that one, and I'll give an honorable mention to a game, and I'm sorry for bringing this up for all the Indiana people out there, but Indiana loses more games in excruciating fashion than almost any program in college football. And I think their game against Penn State is going to be another nail-biter that, unfortunately, I think for the Hoosiers is not going to go on their side, because I think Penn State is better, and I think Penn State will find a way to get the win over Indiana and set up a monumentally massive clash in Nittany Lions Stadium there in Happy Valley, with Penn State hosting Ohio State on Halloween. Going to be a monster game there. I think Penn State finds a way to get the win, but I think it's going to be super close. I talked about that just a second ago in my college football gambling picks to finish the first hour. So we are there's your draft pick, honor of the Big Ten coming back. I am going to watch a college football game that I don't think will be very good. I can't wait to see what's going to happen in that Steelers-Titans game.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.